Hello, this is Chris Champagne, and welcome to Chewing a Yacht, my talk show on WAMF FM 90.3 New Orleans. Well, we started in August, and we've had a great group of guests, so we're going to have a little potpourri of our guests today, little snippets. The first one we're going to have is Jeff Duncan. We just had a debacle with the Saints, so we're going to have Jeff and I kind of talking about things before this season and see how our premonitions and how our thoughts held up over time.
We've got a special guest today. We've got the fine sports writer from NOLA.com, Jeff Duncan, who covers the Saints, LSU, Pelicans, and everything else, I imagine.
Just horse
racing, yeah, and everything, right? Pretty much, huh?
Yeah, I've got the greatest gig, I think, known to man. I can't imagine a better job of being able to cover sports in New Orleans, all sports,
right,
and get paid to do it. I mean,
sure.
People pay money to go do what I do.
Well, I mean, obviously you do a good job, but you wouldn't have the position because you've been here a while now. So they must think you're doing a good job, or they wouldn't. You're the only one left over there, right?
I'm one of the last Mohicans, and I've got them fooled, Chris. Somehow I've got them fooled.
Well, let's hope you continue to fool them. Now, if that's the case, I don't think you're fooling them, but I hope that's the case. Well, listen, let's delve into the Saints, I guess, first, and maybe we'll get to the Pelicans a little just to know. If you don't mind, and maybe a couple other things, but the season is getting ready to, you know, crank up. I mean, the training camp starts next week, this week maybe, huh?
Yes, and Wednesday.
Yeah. So their prospects, I think, are pretty good. I mean, you know, this is a season where people are going, I'm sure, after the success last year, that they are looking for maybe going to the Super Bowl. I mean, if everything falls into place, I mean, you know, football, it's the injuries and break here and there. I mean, the year before, which I think was something that wasn't spoken about enough in 2016, they were just special team snafus away from the playoffs.
Right.
I mean, if they would have had the offensive line coach at Nichols High School in 1952, I think that they would have been in the playoffs.
Yes.
I mean, you know.
That's the NFL, right? There's such parity.
Well, it's true.
That one little thing like that can be the difference. One segment of your game, one injury you mentioned, one bad break can be the difference between 10 and 6 and 6 and 10. And that's why people love the sport so much, because there is such parity. And every year there's always, I think, hope in all 32 markets that
sure,
you can turn it around. We see it happen every
absolutely
year. There's teams that go from 4 wins to 12 wins in one year. And that's the beauty of it.
And if you want to look at it the other way, you can collapse every year as well.
Yeah. And look, the thing I keep bringing up, and hesitate to bring it up, publicly.
Don't say it.
I know.
Okay.
But Drew Brees has played 12 years and missed one game because of an injury.
Right.
It's phenomenal. And I don't know if people understand just how rare that is,
right,
and how unusual that is to play in that game. If you've ever been to an NFL game and been on the sidelines or been just low in the stadium, say at the Superdome, you really get a sense for how violent the game is. And I'm amazed sometimes, Chris, that there's not an injury on every play. These guys just are reckless, the speed, I mean, just sheer physics.
Sure.
And the fact that Drew has only missed one game, a lot of that now is a credit to his toughness. He's played through some injuries. But I guess what I'm getting at is you just never know in the NFL when something like that's going to derail your season. The Green Bay Packers looked like a Super Bowl team a year ago. Aaron Rodgers blows his shoulder out, and they end up missing the playoffs. So
sure,
you never know, but I would say this about this year's team. They're one of many that have a chance. They have a chance. They've got the potential. They've got the talent now around Brees that they could make a playoff run. And then once you get in the playoffs, you never know. But the NFC is very competitive, as you know.
Sure.
And so there's 7 or 8 teams that are probably very similar to the Saints.
Absolutely. I mean, there are teams that are going to be, you don't think are going to be good, who are going to be very good.
Yes.
In the league. That's how, like we just talked about before.
I think team like the Chicago Bears, no one's thinking of them.
Right.
They could put it together and be this year's L.A. Rams.
Right.
You know, that happens all the time.
Well, one of the key things for us getting any place or where we want to go is our division. So how is our division stack up? I mean, there seems to be some disarray with the quarterback in Tampa now. The rest of it, I don't know, you know, what's going on.
Yeah, they've got some challenges in Tampa. We keep hearing about Tampa. This is their season, right? They're going to turn it around. Jameis Winston's going to blossom into the number one pick that we all thought he was. I just don't see it. They seem like a classic franchise, kind of spinning in circles, swimming in circles. It's a different vibe every year. They've got a lot of talent, but they're a classic example of a team lacking direction, lacking leadership. So until they prove it to me, I consider them a cellar dweller again this year. And then I think the Saints are and the Falcons are clearly the class of the division. I have a lot of respect for the people that run the Falcons. I think Matt Ryan is a top quarterback. So those two teams, I think, will battle it out again. And
yeah.
I think Carolina's probably looking at a year, you know, a lot like last year, where they just miss out, but they're going to be a quality competitive team.
Yeah. Well, okay, I just wanted to touch on the division, because I haven't really thought too much about that. Although, I mean, like Winston, I mean, he's like, you know, he's a guy that is very talented, obviously, but there's something going on there. I mean, for me, looking on the outside,
he's immature.
Something wrong with him.
He's an immature guy, you know, and he says the right things, but I'm not sure he does them. And that's a classic leadership flaw. You know, when you're in that position, you've got to be like the CEO. Quarterback of an NFL team is a CEO, and you've got to carry yourself a certain way. All eyes are on you at all times. And when he has these setbacks off the field, I think it undermines his ability to lead grown men that are feeding their families, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very difficult, I think, for them to follow someone like
that.
Well,
sure. Not only that, I mean, not only feeding their families, they're, you know, they've hit the jackpot, in a sense, by making it into the league.
Right.
So you're kind of jeopardizing this jackpot.
Yeah, and look, they want to win, too. I mean, they want to compete. I mean, football is a difficult sport. I mean, let's just get to the point of next practice that we go to.
Yeah.
It's going to be triple-digit heat here in New Orleans. Even in the morning, they have the practice at 9 a.m. We all have been around this week. I mean, you see how hot it is.
Yeah.
You're standing out there in full pads, grinding away. You know, the drudgery of practice, it is difficult. I always compare it to, say, spring training for baseball. I used to work and live down in Florida, and that was like a country club atmosphere. I mean, they come down from the cold winter in February, and they're playing golf in their off seasons.
Yeah.
I mean, in their off time, and they're enjoying it. And meanwhile, football, it's complete drudgery, and it's just difficult. Now, look, they get paid a lot of money, but comparatively speaking, compared to, say, the NBA, it's not that much.
Well, compared to, like, you know, the president of Russia, they don't make much, too.
But
compared to, like, me, they make enough. Okay, I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not against them.
I know.
I want them to get all I can.
Well, that was Jeff Duncan. I want to thank Jeff for being on our show. Hope we can have him on soon to talk about not only what happened in the game, but for the future. The next guest on Chewing the Yat is going to be a little excerpt from our interview with Larry Baron about Larry Baron is a actor in New Orleans, film actor, and he's going to talk about the film industry and his career a little bit for us here. All right, we're back here today with our guest, and today's special guest is Lawrence P. Baron. Hey, Lawrence, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me on.
And Lawrence is a friend of mine, so I may end up calling him Larry occasionally. I'll try not to, but I'll try my best. But I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thanks. And don't worry about that. As I tell people, it's Lawrence when there's paperwork, and it's Larry when we're talking. So either one works.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Lawrence P. Baron is a local film actor of some note here, for sure, in New Orleans. And we're going to talk to him about his career, and hopefully we'll get into some of what the present state of the local film industry is, because I know the tax credit thing has changed, and that's had quite an impact on the amount of productions that are here. I think there's still some things going on. I see the trucks around town, so I'm sure that's still going on, but not quite at the velocity, I guess you'd say, as it used to be. But let's talk about you first. I know that you first, I did a little background, and your first appearance on stage was as a Carrot, I think.
That's right. St. Augustine Kindergarten, Heron Road and Veterans Highway, in about 1961.
Well, were you bitten then by the bug, or did it something that you came later?
I was, and it's a funny story. I had a really bad lisp in those days, and some of the lines weren't designed for people with a lisp, and the way I said them made people laugh. So I got laughs without even trying to. It wasn't even particularly funny, but the way I said things with a lisp made people laugh, and I thought, huh, this is fun.
Oh, well, good. Well, you know, I was so shy that I never really had any aspirations to be, you know, in show business at all, really, because I knew it would be impossible for me. But I did have a similar experience, at least a small part, as a skeleton in a Halloween thing at A.H. Wilson Grammar School. And I don't really remember that much about it, but I'm sure that I was totally and absolutely horrified to be in front of people that were looking at me. So anyway, it's a strange feeling. I also saw an article that your friend Mick Barry, who's an accomplished actor as well, who you went to school with, he did a thing about a book about stage fright.
He did. He has been acting longer than me professionally or seriously, and he wrote this book. And as you notice, he got a lot of people to contribute to this book on stage fright and how they deal with it. A lot of people far more famous than me. And it's a pretty interesting book just to see different coping mechanisms that a lot of people, you wouldn't think had stage fright anymore, but I guess the answer is a lot more of them do, and they all have a different way to cope with it.
Well, I think that if you don't have any stage fright, then there's some kind of a problem.
I think there's probably an accident waiting to happen.
because it just means that you, to me, it just means that you care to a certain, at least enough that you have some kind of an edge. Because I mean, I don't want to talk too much about me because you're the guest, but stage fright was a big deal for me. I was scared to death.
Yeah, you know? I'm a little bit different. I don't get that scared because I tend to over-prepare. So by the time I do something, if I can, I've worked on it so hard that maybe it's not spontaneous anymore, but it doesn't bother me anymore. I think I kind of work till I feel comfortable enough and get some of the fear out that way. Well, I do have what they call the actor's dream every once in a while. We have dreams about not being ready for something and the curtain's about to go up.
Well, I can't imagine anybody preparing more for my 3-minute poems that I used to do on stage than me, but that didn't help my stage fright. I was just, logically, I knew the damn thing.
Right.
And logically, I'm not that famous, so it didn't matter if I knew it or not. You know, if I dropped the line, it didn't matter. You know, so, because it took me a while to figure that out, okay? But now I do get a little nervous, but the way I look at it now is I say to myself, well, it'll be over in 5 minutes, or it'll be over in 3 minutes, or it'll be over an hour if I'm doing a one-man thing. And an hour, even an hour is a long time, but it goes a lot quicker than you think generally, unless it's a disaster. But so you've gone from a carrot, okay, someplace in the environs of New Orleans to kind of co-starring kind of with Michael Douglas.
That's true, but there was a lot in between that.
Well, sure, but that's quite an accomplishment, quite a leap.
It was, and I had a blast doing it. Needless to say, it was my first and maybe my only since then true supporting role, which I call you're not the lead, but you're in the beginning, the middle, and the end of the picture.
Right.
And that was it was still an odd case of circumstances that led me to get that part, because I wasn't even supposed to go read for that part that day. I just happened to notice a marginal note on the Xerox that everybody got saying, this role is not cast yet. And so I asked my agent, hey, can I read for this? Because this looks like a pretty good part.
Right.
You don't necessarily know.
Sure.
When you get the paperwork. And she said, yeah, if you, it was Ryan Glorioso, a local casting director, and he let me do it. And I had whatever the director liked. Of course, you go back and do it again for the director live, and we did it a couple of times, and he cast me in that part. So, needless to say, I had a great time.
Well, so you had there were like three auditions, basically.
We taped one here. No, there weren't three, but at the callback, I had to drive to Shreveport, which it was distinctly remember as I did go from Lafayette, but it was pouring down rain, maybe the worst rainstorm. You try to drive from Lafayette to Shreveport in driving rain. And I was just thinking to myself, I wonder how many other people are making this drive tonight to try to get this part.
WAMF, New Orleans. So, further ado, here we go. Chewing the Yak.
We had an interruption here. We just had the authorities come by looking for an older black man. And Lawrence P. Barron, for the record, is not a black man. He's a white man, so he must be a really great actor. That he can actually impersonate a black man that the authorities want to come look for later.
That's right. I convinced Dog the Bounty Hunter that I'm not who he's looking for today.
That's right. He's a Jedi Knight. I am not the man you're looking for.
That's right.
Okay, so we were we were somewhere, I think, at in Louisiana driving through the rain.
Outside of Alexandria in the rain.
Yeah. This is a pretty interesting, to me, to get to do a movie with someone like Michael Douglas, pretty high level movie star, and you were in contact with him, I assume, in some scenes and got to meet him a little bit, and maybe not pal around, but you were involved in the...
Absolutely. We had a number of scenes together and then with some of the other leads in the picture, the three of us, and unfortunately he did a lot of the stuff he was doing already by the time I showed up, so he was only there for a relative short time when I was there to overlap with me. But we stood around and talked. I have to say, not that I have a lot of experience with two-time Oscar winners, but he said one of the nicer things anybody could say to you after we got finished our big scene, which is a big, just two-shot, as they call it, just he and I. And we finished it, and you stand around and wait and make sure it's okay. And he was kind of looking at me funny. And, of course, that makes you self-conscious. And he asked me, have we ever done anything together, you and I? And you have to understand that's a lot better question than, you've never done this before, have you?
Yeah.
So I was kind of thrilled to think that not only was he satisfied, but maybe he thought that, you know, we had had enough experience together that that showed through.
Right.
And other than that, we had a good time laughing about stuff and, you know, things like that. And, you know, needless to say, I wasn't any kind of threat or competition to his career or anything like that. But he's, you know, just super with me. And I'll always remember that, I think.
I want to thank Larry, also Larry Baron, for coming on the show. And the next excerpt on Chewing a Yacht is going to be our interview with Polly Waring. She has a great DVD set with an interview with Professor Longhair. Never been seen before, so this is one of the most popular shows I think we had this year.
We're delighted to have my dear friend, Polly Waring, come on and talk about this great project that she is almost like a life's work at this point, I would say. It's been going on for a while.
Since 1979, at least 79.
And I say my dear friend because she is my dear friend because she's such a wonderful and terrific, beautiful spirit. So I'm so
Thank
glad
you.
That you're here.
Thank you.
Well, listen, it started out, as far as I can tell,
mm-hmm.
as piano players rarely ever play together.
Yep. That was the genesis.
That was the documentary by your husband, ex-husband, Stevenson Palfy.
Right.
And that was in 1982. Is that
yeah,
right?
That's when it was released.
Released,
uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, well, I'll tell you, and now you've expanded it. You have a relatively new product here called Fess Up, and it mm-hmm. has a feature-length interview with Professor Longhair, which is like 95
right.
minutes.
Right.
And
it was really...
It's a two-CD set, basically. Is that two or three? Two?
Two, okay. Yeah.
And so
one is the original documentary, Piano Players Rarely Ever Play Together.
Right.
Which is a documentary about three generations of New Orleans piano players who influenced each other's music.
And those three piano players are?
The oldest was Toots Washington, who started out playing in the honky-tonks and the barrel houses and the prostitute houses. And the next was Professor Longhair, or Fess to his friends, and he used to hang out when he could with Toots. Toots used to let him sit in sometimes, and even though he was a teenager, he could sneak in there sometimes and sit in with Toots and his band. And then the third generation was Alan Toussaint, who was a huge fan of Professor Longhair's when he was growing up.
Well, it's a really interesting film. I mean, I've seen it, and one of the things that I was struck by was the deferential treatment, an attitude that Alan took towards the other two because they were his elders. And, you know, Alan, I didn't know Alan too well. I had met him a couple of times, and he, one thing about him is he was a gentleman, seemed like, and mm-hmm. Decorum was important to him, and I was just struck by, because he was such a big star himself,
right?
Especially at that point, that he did show that deference of the student basically to two people that he admired. So that mm-hmm. was kind of a cool thing about the documentary
right.
to me. And it was the title itself says Piano Players Rarely Ever Play Together. So I guess there was kind of a rivalry or something like that between Toots and Professor Longhair.
Actually, there wasn't.
No.
That was taken from a line that Alan said during the filming, and he said piano players rarely ever play together because there are rarely more than
one piano
in one place.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, now a lot of people do it.
Well, that's my beef with the piano. It's too big.
Yeah.
If it was just a little bit smaller, I would be okay with that.
No, okay. Easier to move.
Yeah. But yeah, so that I guess that makes perfect sense that there is really, you know, usually there's only one piano in a place.
Right.
Yeah, so that would make it difficult.
Although for this, there was a rehearsal that was planned, and there was going to be. During Stevenson's plan for the documentary was to interview each one individually and at their pianos and have conversations with them and talk about their style of playing and how they were affected and influenced by the other two, and then they were going to all play together in a concert at Tipitina's. But Fest died right before that was supposed to be. About 2 days before, And
so it ended up being a tribute.
The two of them ended up having the concert anyway as a
tribute to Fest.
A tribute, yeah.
And also there's footage of his funeral also.
Right, yeah, there was. There is.
With the blessing of his family.
Mm-hmm.
Which, and of course, that is a real part of New Orleans culture is that kind of a send-off.
Yeah, I had never been to a musical wake before, and it was something.
Yeah,
it was great.
Yeah. Well, you've expanded it now, and you have this new product. It's like a little booklet, and it has two CDs, and it's called Fess Up. Like I think I said that at the beginning.
Right, and the reason we chose Fess was because in December will be his 100th birthday, his centennial. And so we wanted to have this out of respect for him. There's a Stevenson's editor. Stevenson had also started a documentary on Alan Toussaint, and he died before he finished that, and so he left it to his editor in his will, and his editor is finishing that. I think he may have finished it already. So there's already a good documentary about Alan, and there's so little about Toots. He didn't have much family, and he only has one record, although he did play with, I can't remember the musician's name, but he used to play with him.
Well, you know, you might want to get Fox News and CNN to, like, do the Toots, documentary. They could just make it up. They could get together and divide by two. But that's too bad that there's not much, that's one of the things about art. You know, if you don't get some kind of a record of it, it dissipates into the wind.
Right.
So this is really an important document that, you know, mm-hmm. Stevenson and you and others have put together. And
right, we had a good team.
It's especially, I mean, if you're really into New Orleans music, or just music in general, I mean, it's really fascinating and really well done.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're looking for a gift for a friend of yours or a loved one who is really into music, I think this is really a terrific gift.
Right.
So we can't say any prices on our station, but you can tell us how to get it.
Yes, you can go to Louisiana Music Factory either online, or if you live here, you can go down there. Or you can go to their storefront on Amazon. Amazon itself is selling it for more than our storefront, than Louisiana Music Factory. So it's best to just go to their website.
I want to thank Polly and for coming on the show. I really appreciate it very much for her sharing her thoughts and her DVDs and with us here. Our next guest is the great Tom McDermott, one of the best piano players, not the best piano player in town. Thanks a lot. We have a few more minutes, so we're not through yet, but I just wanted to throw that in. I'm kind of new at this radio stuff, and I have to let them know what they're listening to occasionally here.
Sure.
Is there a song that... If you're someplace where people are requesting music, is there a song that someone requests and you're always really happy when they request that, a particular song, maybe, that you can think of?
Well, I like it when people ask for Brazilian music or Booker. you know, it's just it's good to be associated with Booker.
Right.
I've really put, at one time, I was just so crazy about his music. He's still my favorite pianist ever, I would say. But I was just so deeply into him. It was mania, you know. And eventually I stopped, like, trying to learn his pieces as he played them, because you're never going to be as good. You just can't simulate his touch. And then I just took, like, ideas from him, especially his left hand. This one particular left hand, and I started applying them to 60s pop tunes that wouldn't sound very good with other left hands. And it's been fun. Just today I played at a gig a Beatles tune, From Me to You, with this Booker style. Kid, unlike most of the pop music of the time, and I so appreciate them these days as a working musician, because oftentimes I'm in a room and, you know, there might be 20, 30-year-olds who really don't even, they've never seen a piano player, really, hardly. I mean, it's like they don't understand the idea that, you know, I'm pressing a key and it's hitting a string, and, you know, I've met like 9-year-olds who have never seen a piano, or just like gawking. Like, anyway, there's not much piano music out there for them to even listen to. You know, that Alicia Keys, Ben Folds Five. I don't know who else is out there. It's just like, in any case, hopefully they know the Beatles, and oftentimes they do. And I know the Beatles album One, which was their greatest hits, most recent greatest hits package, was at one time the best-selling album of the new millennium.
Okay.
So,
well, that's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, it's good to know. So, you know, any boomers that have...
Well, it was a treat visiting with Tom and listening to him at his studio, and I want to thank Tom again for coming on Chewing the Yacht. The next guest is going to be Cheryl Gerber. Cheryl Gerber, many of you probably might not know Cheryl, but you do know her in a way, because she's been the photographer for Gambit for many, many years, and she's a delight. She's one of the treasures of our community, and I was so happy and excited to have her come on, because she's been a friend of mine for a very long time. So there's a little excerpt from our interview with Cheryl Gerber.
Well, we have a special guest today, Cheryl Gerber. who's a photographer. Many of you may know from Gambit, and I've known Cheryl for a really long time. And Cheryl is one of the nicest and shining lights of our city, and has been all of her life here, as far as I can tell. And I'm really delighted that that she could join us. And I think she's a little trepidatious, as many people are, about being interviewed. And but she shouldn't. She's golden. And I mean that. I mean, I'm a lunatic, but I'm a sincere lunatic. You know, one of the things I like to talk about people when they who have some success in their life, I like to talk about how they got started, because often I think that one of the things that I noticed about I'll let you do most of the talking, but I just want to set this up a little bit. I notice when I read biographies of famous people, the first chapters of their biographies are often the most revealing and the most valuable, and I think there should be like a class in all schools for grammar school kids to read the first chapters of famous people's books, because their biographies, because it tells you where they came from, mm-hmm. and they didn't all become what they are overnight, and there was some travail and some struggle, and obstacles to what they did. Almost everybody, even people who you know supposedly have privilege, whatever, they come with those the vicissitudes of life as well. So, by doing this show and talking to other people, I found over time that most of them, the way they got started, people don't really know that story. So if you wouldn't mind telling us that.
Yeah, sure. And thanks for equating me with maybe somebody famous. But anyway, I was born in New Orleans, but like so many of the people back in the 60s, we were part of the white flight and moved to the North Shore, rural North Shore. So I grew up over there. A lot of people might be surprised to know that I grew up in a trailer. My parents, who were lovely people, were very uneducated. My dad grew up Amish in Indiana and probably only went to the 10th grade. And my mother grew up in New Orleans in the Irish Channel and only went to the 7th grade. But you knew my mother, and yes. she was quite a character. Despite not being educated, she loved to write.
Right, she was a poet.
She was a poet. She was a playwright. She wrote a book. I mean, nothing that was ever published, but she was very passionate about it and devoted quite a few years to doing that. So I think watching her creativity kind of pushed me along that route, and then my dad, with his Amish work ethic, pushed me in that direction. But, you know, growing up on the North Shore, which was a lovely, fine place to grow up, we weren't really exposed to a lot of different cultures, a lot of different kinds of people, and I was always curious about other people. So when it was time for me to go to college, I didn't have a clue what I was going to study, and I didn't even know if I was going to go to college. It was something that was never talked about in our household. It just wasn't on the radar. If you finished high school, you were doing pretty good. So when I got to college, I studied general studies for like two semesters. Then I had a guidance counselor, and he's like, you know, you got to pick something. And I said, okay, I'll take liberal arts. And he's like, yeah, but you got to emphasize something. And we started talking. Do you like business? Do you like science? No. Do you like math? No. What do you like? Well, I like meeting people, different kinds of people. So we narrowed it down to journalism. And I started studying journalism then and thought it would be really kind of a fun life to interview people and get to know people. So that's what I did. And I worked on a couple of newspapers.
Where'd you go to school?
Southeastern Louisiana okay. University. And I ended up working, doing an internship at the Daily Star with Lillian Miranda. And then I went to the St. Tammany News Banner and quickly realized that I was not a good writer. My editor would fill my pages up with red ink. And one day they gave me a camera to go take pictures with the story. And so I started taking pictures, and the pictures got bigger, the stories got smaller, and the rest was history. I decided I really wanted to work in photography.
Oh, good. So then did you study that then, or did you just...
I didn't study it, but I actually, my first job in New Orleans after I graduated was at New Orleans Magazine. I just happened to walk into New Orleans Magazine the day they fired their editorial assistant, so I got a call the next day and started working there. But they were doing like a buyout. Bill Medcalf owned New Orleans Magazine at the time, and he was trying to sell it to somebody. And to make the numbers work, he had to fire everybody. So I got laid off shortly after I, you know, was working there. While I was laid off, I started trying to think of how I could be a photographer. It didn't seem feasible to me because I didn't have an education in photography. But then I discovered the photographs of Michael P. Smith. I had never met him. I just saw his photographs around town, and I was blown away. I was like, that's what I want to do. So I started calling Michael Smith back when we used to have the white pages and you could actually find somebody.
Yeah.
And he kind of just kept putting me off, I don't know, 4 or 5 times that I called over several months, and he wasn't calling me back. So I was looking in the classifieds for a job and ended up in Honduras teaching English. It was either that or working on a cruise ship. And while I was in Honduras, Michael sent me a postcard and he goes, I thought of something you can do for me when you get back. So when I came back, he let me live in his studio, which was full of his photographs, full of books, full of everything. And he said, make yourself at home. You can have access to everything here, but you can't, you know, have one rule. You can't change the radio station, WWOZ. So coming from living, you know, on the North Shore and living in New Orleans just for a short time, then Honduras, then back to New Orleans, Michael really exposed me to what I loved about New Orleans, the street culture and all of that. And I've been trying to do that ever since.
Well, you do a great job.
Thank you.
And I'm really happy to have you here. And it, you know, it's interesting, you know, everybody, you know, young people now, they want to be they want to be Queen Elizabeth on day one, you know, or, you know, so it's interesting, you know, cruise ship, Honduras, Southeastern, and, you know, and I was just thinking, you know, places like Southeastern don't get enough credit. I mean, you know, you have these smaller universities that give people an opportunity at a higher education.
Yeah, definitely.
And I mean, these things are incredibly valuable. I mean, our junior colleges as well. You know, I mean, we live in a strange world now. I mean, not that it was any different, I suppose, before, but of, you know, prestige is so great, except when it's not,
right.
Then it isn't, then it is, and it depends on what time of day it is, and, you know what I mean? You know, and, well, listen, what are some of your favorite moments? I know this is kind of putting you on the spot. Some of your favorite moments. So how long have you been working for Gambit, by the way?
It's been almost 25 years.
Yeah,
I wanted to work at Gambit as soon as I picked it up in the early 90s, and David Richman was the photographer there at the time. He was the staff photographer, and I palled around with him. He was quite an eccentric figure and taught me a lot. But they didn't need another photographer. He was on, I guess, what they would call a retainer. So he would farm some things out to me, like restaurant guides and those sort of things. And I was working at the gumbo shop as a waitress, and a friend of mine said, you know, at some point you're just going to have to jump off and just take the plunge and go do photography. I said, oh, God, I don't know how I'm going to do that. So I was hanging out at Caldi's, hanging photographs in Caldi's, the old coffee shop back in the day. And there were, it was during the time when all the gutter punks started arriving and people were wondering about the gutter punks. And I was wondering, too. And I thought, well, maybe I'll just do a story. A friend of mine said, if you're so curious about the gutter punks, why don't you just do a story on it? So I did. I went and hung out with them for a couple of months, took pictures, wrote the story, and submitted it to Gambit. And I've been working there ever since.
That was Cheryl Gerber. Thank you, Cheryl, so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. I hope we can do that again sometime. And little snippet of our interviews on Chewing a Yacht in our first half year on the air here on WAMF FM 90.3 in New Orleans is with Bruce Spicer. Now, Bruce is an Orleanian, went to Newman, graduated from Tulane Law School. He's a local attorney, and he's one of the, if not, the foremost expert on the Beatles on Earth. He's written 10 books at least about the Beatles, and this is about his latest book about the White Album.
And today we have a special guest, an Orleanian, could be and probably is the foremost Beatle expert on the planet Earth, Bruce Spicer. Thank you.
Well, I'm certainly the most qualified expert in this radio room right now. No doubt about that.
Well, that's anybody I'm in a room with.
That's true.
On any subject.
That's true.
So I got that going for me.
All right.
But you know, don't be modest. You are, in fact, one of the foremost Beatles experts in the world. In fact, how many books on the Beatles have you written?
I've now written 10. I have my 10th one that'll be coming out this November, and this November is the 50th anniversary of the release of what is known as the White Album, the Beatles double album. And, Chris, I remember those 50 years ago like it was a couple of weeks ago. I remember a Friday where I got home from school, and before going out, I was listening to WTIX, and they heard played a song by the Beatles I hadn't heard before, and the disc jockey said that the Beatles had a new album that'd be coming out soon, and they'd be playing songs from it throughout the weekend. And all weekend long, I kept hearing these really great Beatles songs I'd never heard before, and it was a real exciting weekend for me.
I bet. I mean, well, you know, whenever a Beatles album would come out in those days, it was an event, certainly, among people of our generation particularly.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know if people today can appreciate what an event it was and the anticipation leading up to it. And WTIX in those days used to have a thing they did called the Top 10 at 10, where they would play the 10 most requested songs of the evening at 10 o'clock at night. And I remember by that Wednesday, for something they had started playing that Friday, all songs in the top 10 were from the new Beatles album.
Right. Yeah, well, they used to have a lot of, I mean, they had so many songs that were on the charts. I mean, I had a friend of mine who was a musician when we went from the time that he was about 11. And so he was into music, and we would discuss it sometimes. And he would say that he'd never heard a Beatles song he didn't like.
Yeah.
You know, I remember Baby, You Can Drive My Car came on the radio one time when his mom was driving us back from like a basketball game at Tulane or something. And,
uh-huh.
And his family was also music, you know, people. And they couldn't see the any of the beauty in that, in that particular song. It was somewhat unusual, but they had unusual songs. That's one of the things that I liked about them. They had a different take on music, you know.
Yeah, and that was the thing that I think makes the White Album so popular among people is that it covers so many different genres of music.
Right.
And I remember that whole weekend, you know, I'd hear a song, well, that sounds almost like a country western type Bob Dylan song, and then that sounds like a Chuck Berry song, and you know, all of a sudden you've got a beautiful ballad, and then really loud. I don't think we really used the term heavy metal back in 1968, but Helter Skelter certainly would fit that definition now. And then there was this weird sound collage that when I bought the album, I learned was called Revolution 9. And it was, I mean, it was just incredible because it was like, you know, all weekend long, and that week it was like the song in Glass Onion where John says, here's another clue for you all. That's what you were getting for an entire week. Another clue about what the new album is going to be like.
Well, it was that's. I think that was my favorite album because it's, first of all, because there's so many songs and it's so eclectic.
Yes.
You know, and
my favorite too, by the way.
Is it really? Oh, well, you must enjoy doing this new book then, especially.
Absolutely. You know, it was fun doing it. And when I did my research, going back to old issues of Rolling Stone and Time and Newsweek and things, it was interesting to see the reviews, and I'd remember it didn't get a good review in Time magazine, and when I reread the review, it still wasn't that nice a review, although they did like the songwriting, but kind of called it a motley assemblage of songs or something, and
yeah.
The Beatles, you know, best abilities and worst tendencies or some famous quote like that, but Rolling Stone praised it, and Rolling Stone was about a year old at the time, and they gave it about a 4-page spread with pictures from a photographer at the time known as Linda Eastman, who would later become Paul's wife.
Right. You know, I can't really think of an example except for one that you just said, but there are a lot of things that in our culture, songs, movies, books, that are like iconic now or in our culture, that if you look back to the original reviews of like the mainstream press like Time or New York Times, they got panned
mm-hmm.
often. You know, so things sometimes grow over time and accrue value that they didn't necessarily weren't seen at the moment of their inception, artistically
yeah.
anyway.
No, I mean, and the goofy thing about it, the New York Times, when Sgt. Pepper came out, Richard Goldstein panned the album. And when the White Album came out, three different people for the New York Times actually wrote pieces on the album, and two of them panned it, but Richard Goldstein gave it a good review. So you never know,
right.
But it's fun historically to see how these things were judged when they came out.
Absolutely.
And yeah. One of the things the book does is it goes through, you know, the different reviews in the different magazines and newspapers in the United States and also in the UK. You know, how the London Times, you know, what did William Mann of the London Times think of it? Gave it a pretty good review. So, you know, you get that thing. And I think it got better reviews, I think, in the UK than in the U.S., but the album did better in the U.S. than it did in the U.K., if that makes any sense.
Well, sure it does. Because I mean, if you, especially if you were from that era, you would realize that there were some songs, Beatles songs, that made it into the top 10 in England that didn't make it here.
Yeah.
And vice versa, because just people,
just a different taste.
Yeah, different taste, absolutely. Well, you know, how I want to talk a lot more about the new book, but let's mention some of the older books that you have too, if you don't
sure.
mind, so people know how, tell us how people can get them too. I mean, we can't say any prices, but you can just
No.
Just say that they're available and
yeah,
what they're
available.
Are.
You know, through, of course, internet's everywhere, including my own. Can I say my own website?
Yeah, you can give your website.
My website is very easy to remember. It's beetle.net. No S on it. So beetle.net.
And you have 9 books are in print already besides the new one.
I have that, but out of that, actually 5 of the, or let's see, 4 of the books have sold out.
Okay.
And so out of the 4 that have sold out, 3 of them are available in a revised and expanded digital edition now.
Okay. All right. So that's beetle.com.
Net.
Sorry. Pardon me.
That's quite all right.
Beetle.net. That's pretty simple. Even an idiot like me could remember that if I was in my car. Beetle.net. Because it's like, you know, one of these long things, you know. Well, how did this all happen that you became such enamored of the Beatles?
Yeah. Well, I was enamored on the Beatles. You know, putting it in terms of New Orleans, what is the number one question you ask anyone in New Orleans? Where did you go to school?
Right.
I went to Newman. I was on the Newman school bus in early 1964. And I heard this song that just kind of sounded really different to me, and it was I Want to Hold Your Hand. And I heard it a couple of more times, you know, on the radio at home, because I had a radio, you know, I think the word was from my parents that my first 2 sentences were, Daddy, I want an ice cream cone, and Mommy, I want a radio. I had older sisters. They had a transistor radio. I wanted a radio in my room. And so I got a radio in my room when I was a little kid and loved listening to WTIX, you know, that was, you know, I never listened to WNOE. You know, you grew up in New Orleans, you were one or the other.
That's right.
It was very territorial, so I was one of the boss jocks. I was not a good guy.
Okay. Yeah, it was either I was going to mention that before, it was either WNOE or WTIX, yeah.
Yeah, that was it. But I absolutely loved the music, and the first album that I bought, and I didn't have enough money to buy it myself, so my mom got it for me, was Meet the Beatles.
Okay.
And I had a cousin, Barry, and his first album was Introducing the Beatles. So between the two of us, we had their first 2 available U.S. albums.
I want to thank Bruce for coming on the show. That was really a treat to have him on, and it's a great interview. Our next guest on Chewing a Yat is the great Sue Gonzi, better known as Hoda Mayo on WSLA's Radio Free New Orleans, but also one of the shining lights of the theater community in New Orleans. Hi, Sue.
Hey, hi, Chris.
Thanks so much for coming by and taking some time to talk with us.
Thank you.
Now, you have a background in radio. We've spoken about that. Most people in New Orleans know you as the incredibly competent and wonderful tech guru of New Orleans theater.
Oh, yeah, and the voice of Le Chat Noir. That's the one I always thought
voice
was
of,
funny.
That's right. You're the voice that they would hear on the reservation line. And
that's it.
And information line. So, and of course, we all lament the passing of the great, late, great Le Chat Noir.
Oh, here now.
Yeah. Well, but you do have a background in radio, and it was an interesting story you told me. I want to start off with that, if we can, about when you were in radio in California, San Francisco, I believe,
sure.
About the Iranian hostages, the famous hostages when Jimmy Carter was president of the United States. So you want to take it from there?
Well, I was in radio, started out in rock and roll radio, and when our station bought another station, it was a news and talk station, and they needed somebody that could chatter. So they moved me over there, and my job was to produce talk shows. I was the one who would call out. Well, it was before Google. So people would call in, ask weird questions, and I would do anything necessary to find the answer to that question. I had, remember the days of Sprint? I had an unlimited Sprint account so I could call anywhere in the world. So we heard about the invasion and the takeover of the embassy, and I thought, wow. That's very strange. How can we find out about that? And you could hear the guys in the newsroom just going out of their minds. It was like everybody wanted an angle. Find an angle. Well, I thought, we'll let our fingers do the walking.
Walking, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I went into the newsroom and said, you know, there's a book, and it has all the phone numbers for the embassy, United States embassies around the world. Do you have the book? Oh, sure. Well, we called the embassy. I called the embassy. And it rang, and it rang, and it rang, and it rang. And finally, somebody actually picked up the phone.
Wow.
And said, hello. So what do you do? Now you know you're talking to somebody that's completely stressed out. I was completely stressed out. I couldn't believe it. We had no computers, so you couldn't write a message to the person on air and have them read it on a screen. I had a great big art tablet and a Marklot, as a friend of mine says, and I was just writing, have embassy in Tehran, line one, going to send, turn the page, to you. And I'm talking to the kid and saying, we understand that you're under a lot of pressure, and we're just worried about everybody, including you. Like, do you have food? Do you have water? We know it's probably going to be a while. Do you have a place to sleep? Has anybody made any plans for all of this? And the kid, he just, I don't know, he just talked to me.
Yeah, he's an American kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it was just the strangest experience. And I told him, I said, listen, I'm a lady and I'm on the radio in California, and I would like our listeners to hear your story, to hear your side of what's going on. So do you think you'd be interested in that? Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'm hopping up and down. I'm my little headset. I'm hopping up and down. And the guy that's the host of the radio show, Peter Laufer, is saying, I think Sue has something interesting for us, and we're going to be going to that line in just a moment. And I'm talking to the kid continually and saying, okay, I'm going to put you on hold, and you're going to talk to a real nice guy. His name is Peter. He feels the same way I do, but I'm going to hit this button, and it'll be quiet for a minute, and then Peter will immediately come on the line and talk to you. Can we do that?
Yes.
I said, I need to call you something. Do you have a name? But no, don't give a name. I said, well, what are we going to call you? I said, let's call you Student X. How's that? And he said, okay. So I said, okay, here we go. I'm going to put you on hold, and then the man named Peter is going to talk to you, okay?
Okay.
Put him on hold, point at Peter. Peter picks him up and does this extensive interview with the guy. Well, at this point, here come all the news guys into the production room going, what? And when Peter was kind of getting to the end of the conversation, I'm writing, give him back to me. Put him back. Peter said, I'm going to put you on hold. Sue's going to pick you up again. So I got him back on the phone, and I said, that was great. You did great. You sounded fine, and we really got the idea of what's happening. Do you think I could call you tomorrow? About the same time and the same phone number? Would that be okay? Okay. So we said goodbye, and I hung up. And the next day, I dialed in again, and the kid picked up the phone.
Right. Student X.
We had a nice conversation, a little bit looser, because he knew now that it was Sue, and we still loved the idea that he was Student X. It was just fabulous. And he talked to Peter again. The third day, there was an interrupt from the State Department on the line, so I couldn't call in. So that was the end of my discussions with Student X, and the funniest thing about it was the AP... put out on the old wire. Remember the old the story went on the AP wire, and my boss said, I hate you. I said, well, why? This is great. This is fabulous. And he said, they mentioned your name first.
Well, y'all should have won some kind of an award for that.
Oh, it was just the show was so much fun. It was called Instant Gratification.
Well, thank you for listening to Chewing the Yacht. I hope you've enjoyed listening to our snippets of all our some of our guests that we had on the first 6 months here on the air. And I hope that we'll have some great. I know we will have some great guests in the future. And I want to thank WAMF FM 90.3 New Orleans for having me on the air on Chewing the Yacht. Thank you.